Welcome to another episode of The Download here at WGNRadio.com. Well, my guest today, award-winning filmmaker Eugene Jarecki. His new documentary, The King, is at the Music Box. And of course,
it's about Elvis.
Oh, that's Elvis's? That's actually his Rolls Royce.
Oh, my God.
You remember the great Chuck D line?
Elvis was a hero the most, but he never meant to me. Straight up racist, that sucker was simple and plain. Mother him and John Wayne.
You ain't never the
thing that Elvis had, it was black and it was white, it's all mixed up together.
He was the voice of the country at its best and at its worst.
Oh, make us say, make us say.
That's where we are in America. Where's the second act? Where's it just all gone to hell?
What is wrong with America?
The world just doesn't know where America is headed.
Where does the country go from here?
Does she come back to me?
The documentary charts the rise and decline of Elvis Presley from his days at Sun Records to his final days in Las Vegas. Then Jarecki uses Elvis's 1963 Rolls-Royce as the focal point for interviews. He goes on a cross-country road trip through the eyes of the king of rock and roll. And the film features interviews with Ethan Hawke, Chuck D, Alec Baldwin, Emmylou Harris, John Hyatt, just to name a few. And even though this film is about the rise and decline of Elvis, Jarecki uses him as a metaphor for the rise and decline of America. The film premiered at the Cannes Film Festival and was at Sundance this past year. And now it's at the Music Box Theater on Southport. Eugene Jarecki, thanks for being my guest.
I'm thrilled to be here.
It's amazing. I have so many questions. I mean, it's a delight. The movie is a delight. It really is. I don't know much about Elvis Presley, and I think that's because there's just overkill about him and my parents' generation and on and on and on. What did you know about Elvis before you got into this project?
Well, I grew up certainly loving Elvis because I was somebody who had a nostalgic personality. I always thought it was so beautiful back then with those candy-colored chrome Detroit machines driving on the highways of blue open sky country. And I had that set of dreams growing up, partly because I'm the child of immigrants and the American dream had brought us here when we fled Nazi Germany and Russia on the other side. And so I grew up prepared to love the American dream, but my folks who came here were sensitive people, and they quickly saw when they came to America that the American dream was more complicated than that, right? That it wasn't available to everybody. So while I had, you know, it was available to white people, to white men, women didn't get it, black people didn't get it. So the American dream was a work in progress. It was an unfinished story. And I knew that, but nonetheless, I had this nostalgic side. Elvis was square in the middle of that because he was absolutely inseparable from the idea of the American dream, that you could come out of nowhere, the sticks of Mississippi, and rise
right
to the highest points in the sky.
I was always blown away because for me to understand Elvis, I was born in 1974, and the only thing that really stays with me about Elvis, of course, is the music, but then also he died a day after my birthday. My dad always told me that, you know, on August 16th. But there are so many different Elvises that gets captured in pop culture history. In your film, you really cover it all, and that's the part that you start to see a bigger picture about who Elvis was and his relation to the American dream.
People said to me, you know, you could have made this film about any number of celebrities. Michael Jackson, who dies prematurely and it's so tragic. Marilyn Monroe, etc. There's no one quite like Elvis in the range of Americanness with which he's identified. When Elvis is a young nobody coming out of nowhere, he is that American dream figure we
dream of. He works hard. If you work hard, you get something, right?
Yeah, and he's got talent, and he can get through, whereas in old Europe, he wouldn't have been able to because he's a poor person, wouldn't have gotten a chance. So there, right away, he's interlinked with the Declaration of Independence. Ethan Hawke and others talk about this young Elvis as this raw force that comes out of nowhere. But he's complicated because he's a white kid who, because he's poor, is marinated in blackness. So now the American dream story, which was pretty glossy, after 1 second with Elvis gets a bit more complicated because he has the daring at the time to be natural. And natural means he's playing music that comes out of the black community, and he's a white kid in the 1950s. Chuck D is in the film, who of course famously calls Elvis
right,
racist.
Fight the power,
and
right.
Fight the power. And I bring Chuck D to talk to us. And first of all, Chuck D is an international treasure. He is an intellect so vast, it's hard to keep up with him in an interview. He keeps spinning your thoughts around. When you think one thing, 2 seconds later, he's literally changed your mind in front of you like a brain magician. So Chuck D sits down, and I think he's going to say racist, racist, racist. And what he says is, oh my God, no. When Elvis launches and is a white guy willing to play black music, he should be celebrated for that. That's a hero. He could have gotten hung for that, but he has the purity of spirit to want to share culture. And Chuck says we should all share culture.
And he also points that out, that that's the American way. That's what we've been doing.
And if we do it good, we're doing that.
Right.
We should not eat each other's food and not play each other's music. A real society, a real democracy, we would celebrate each other's food, music, religion, beliefs, traditions. So when Elvis does that, that's Elvis breaking out and making America confront, for example, the proximity between white poverty and black poverty, that really you're dealing with a class system here. You've got poor people of all shades, and they've got common cause. Well, that's a radical notion before the 1960s.
Yeah.
He's way ahead of his time. And what's he doing with his pelvis? He's unleashing what white America, conservative America, thinks is basically unchecked, unfiltered blackness into American living rooms. Elvis's pelvis, as we always heard, that was a serious radical political force for America. And he starts to turn the system up and upside down. From every point onward in his life, he symbolizes something absolutely elemental about what's happening to this country.
Hey, you're absolutely right. And you think about the others, and as you mentioned, Marilyn Monroe or Michael Jackson, and yes, they have similar...
They've got stuff.
Yeah, they got stuff.
Yeah.
But every single part of Elvis's chapters in his life, they do embody, in a way, this American spirit, that whether it's his time in the military or his time in Hollywood or even his time in Las Vegas, there seems to be, yes, a metaphor or at least a parallel to who we are as a country and how we view the Americans... experience.
As I started to travel in his Rolls Royce, not only through
through
the geography of America, all the places he went, but through, I was really traveling through time in a lot of ways, I discovered that what is special about Elvis is he is present at the creation of the key things that have happened to us over the last century, which is to say, when he's in Hollywood, it's the golden age of Hollywood, and he's making B movies. So in other words, he starts as a golden age figure making wonderful things like, you know, King Creole, but he ends up making things like Clam Bake and loser B movie films that are tragic to look at, because he's there bridging when America goes from great, of which he's a part because he's a young heartthrob at that moment with Brando and others, but then it loses its way and he starts to turn south. The same is true of the military. Elvis is the face of the American military. He is the most high-profile drafted person in American history who loves his mama and goes to serve his country when his country calls.
By design, yeah.
And when John Lennon commented on this, who loved Elvis and the Beatles adored Elvis until they felt that Elvis lost his way, John Lennon says, look, Elvis went into the military and got a crew cut. He says, I think they cut off a little more than that. Because when Elvis got back, he was an emasculated Elvis. And that's symbolic, too. That's what it was like. When you take a figure like Elvis and you make him represent the new age of American military imperialism, the country is changing and he's branding
that. Absolutely. And it's so true, because you think about his military experience, which he gets out in 1960. The next phase of American military is Vietnam.
Right.
And the military changes its perception after with a very high profile, very controversial war.
Yes.
It's similar. And even when you think about, you know, what he did at the latter part of his life, where he went to Las Vegas and did that performance and the way that he kind of turned out and how we kind of viewed him, you're absolutely right that he almost every chapter of his life has a beginning, middle, and end.
One of the things I was focused on, and I was making this film before the 2016 election, so I would be sitting here today talking about the same set of forces in Elvis and in America that we are now dealing with in America right now. Those are not a surprise in my film. Those are, I was worried about this country being metaphorically linked to Elvis because we were young once and beautiful, like him. We rose too fast, like him. We became an adolescent, basically with the whole world in our hand and unprepared for that. So like him, we developed all kinds of fissures and fractures in our soul. And like him, we as Americans reach out to all manner of quick fix. Like him, carbohydrates, drugs, consumption, vanity, violence, all of that.
Fame,
is Elvis.
Right.
Fame, right? All that adulation of something that will soothe us, make us feel it's more meaningful, make us soothe the fractures in our heart. Well, we are like him. Well, he dies on the toilet. At 42, he has a premature death where he succumbs to what? To the power and the money that have destroyed him. I was making a film about the power and the money destroying this country's democracy, this film, before this election happened, which couldn't have been a more metaphoric case study I don't want to use his name, but the occupant of the Oval Office right now is, it's safe to say, the embodiment of every single thing that destroyed Elvis Presley.
Ethan Hawke has a tremendous, tremendous role in this film. Ashton Kutcher in his very, the role that he plays as well, talking about fame. Alec Baldwin as well, even the interactions you catch him with fans and people talking. But a lot of them talk about, and Ethan Hawke's piece of it, he has a great, towards the end of the film, he talks about money and that Elvis chose money. And you see where Elvis ended up. And that's the point to me that I think still resonates today, is this idea that we are all choosing money, that's the American dream. You know, this was the Ronald Reagan swimming pool thing. Yeah. This idea that we could be rich, or yeah, we should go after the brass ring. Yes. And we're seeing the detrimental effects of that playing out in our society.
Sure. Think about it this way. And it's part of why I called the movie The King. I didn't just call it The King because Elvis is called The King. It was about something larger. Mike Myers is in the film. And he marvels at how a country, remember, he's from Canada, so he looks at America through this interesting lens as a neighbor. And he says, why does my neighbor, this country that broke off from England, the King of England, and broke off saying no more kings and queens. Right. Why is this country still obsessed with royalty? With King of Beers, Muffler King, King Size Mattress, Elvis the King. What is this about us that didn't get the memo that this whole thing was supposed to be about of the people, by the people, for the people? A country boy isn't supposed to become a king. He's supposed to be a proud, loving country boy who might have a bunch of money because he's successful, but he's in his community. We're raising barns together. We're cheek by jowl. He's an unassuming, powerful person. He's a leader among equals. But instead, what we've come to in this society is, look how many Americans sit and are glued to the tube, yeah, to watch the royal wedding, and that, or the crown. In a country that broke off from that country, and I'm not trying to badmouth England, but can you imagine if the founding fathers came back and they spilt blood, they dumped tea in the ocean and risked their lives to break off from the king, and it turns out we're actually still obsessed with it.
Yes, it's amazing to think about, and also to think about, and many people have said this about Elvis and have talked about him being unwitting, or this idea that he was along for the ride, meaning he didn't know what was happening, that Colonel Parker or the corporate people who control Paramount or RCA, they played with him, they used him, if you will, and I wonder about that. I wonder about how much of Elvis's story is pure and authentic, and how much of it is driven by corporate interest taking advantage of an artist.
Chuck D is amazing on that in the movie. And also Elvis's best friend, Jerry Schilling, who I asked this of at one point. And I said to Jerry, I was in the middle of ranting, as you can hear I do sometimes, about capitalism and how it's destroying America and democracy. And I was telling him all this. And I said, it seems to me that capitalism is hijacking American democracy so that the rich get richer and this 0.001% run the world to their benefit and everybody else is scrambling to get by. And we haven't figured out that that's just not America. So I said, this is wrong. And it's just like what the Colonel did to Elvis. And he said, well, wait a minute there. He says, I'm the first person to say that I think the Colonel overdid this with Elvis. And the Colonel signed Elvis up for a life that led to his demise. But he said, you should know, and it's important to keep this in mind, Elvis loved the Colonel like a father. He wrote it to him in a letter, and he loved what the Colonel did for him. Sure, the Colonel took 50% of everything Elvis ever made, which is an ungodly percentage for a manager. But Eugene, it was 50% of the universe. Nobody had ever made anything like this. And Elvis liked that money, and he liked that power. His girlfriend, Linda Thompson, is in the film, and she talks about how every 30 seconds, being his girlfriend, every 30 seconds, somebody would come along to him and say, I want to be with you.
Right.
And how's he supposed to be a regular boyfriend? Right? So a lot happened to Elvis that makes him a victim, where Emmylou Harris in the film talks about how Elvis was the first that this had happened to.
And
at
the time, the only, right?
The only. He had no reference for how to be a supernova and how to keep his wits about him. And so you have to have a huge amount of empathy for all that was coming to him. But he's also a human being, and we are human beings, and we have to see ourselves as victims. We all didn't expect this democracy to become so corrupt, because we read these history books that tell us about checks and balances and the separation of powers and how special we are. But you can boil a frog in warm water, and this society got crept up on, snuck up on by capitalism and this winner-take-all monstrosity that we're dealing with now. And that is where we are victims, and we are electing or not voting or not getting out in the street or not doing what we need to do to demand that the society be what we need it to
be. Aren't we falling victim to the same manipulations that that, say, Elvis did in the way, yes, he liked that, and he liked the power, he liked the money, but he was chosen as a great indicator or poster child, if you will, for America, for the American dream. Yes. Even the idea of orchestrating the idea of going to the army, that was all about his image. He was a great person to say, you can make it here. See, Elvis made it. When don't look over here.
Right.
Don't
that's look, exactly yeah, right. Yeah. And that's this Kool-Aid that's in the American dream. If you watch my trailer online, which I suggest people do because it really gives a good sense of the film, go read down at the comments, and you won't believe how much hate mail is in those comments and why. Maybe it's because Chuck D's in the trailer, and people who are devout Elvis fans assume
it's just going to be about race, right?
That he's going to be critical of Elvis, when in fact Chuck D adores Elvis in a very interesting way in the film. He makes Elvis more beautiful and majestic almost than anybody, while also talking about American racism writ large as a country. But why are they so upset at the film? I think it's because it threatens to take away their Kool-Aid, because Americans have become something we were never meant to be. We were meant to be a work in progress with an engaged citizenry that knew that it's only the people, the of the people, we the people, we the people, all that stuff. It's only us who compel the system to be what it's supposed to be. You can't lean back and think that the leader is going to do that. That's what kings do. So what's interesting is that I think people got comfortable in this country. And I don't mean they're comfortable. A lot of your listeners are like trying to make ends meet. So it's not like you're opting for money. They're like, I'd like to opt for money. There's no money for me to opt for. Right. What the point is that they are opting for a society where, for example, we don't boycott. We don't strike. At best right now against this rapacious White House, you see some protests, and that's great. And there's been some amazing stuff since he's come into office in protest against him. But protests are just the beginning. Unless you're willing to throw yourself upon the gears of the machine and cause it to be unable to operate, you will not get public policy results. People talk about France, how they strike all the time, England, how they strike all the time, and we make fun of them. That's democracy. That's how democracy imposes on an economic system how it has to function to respect human dignity. Until we start to do that here, we are Elvis asleep at the wheel watching this whole thing unravel.
And as you mentioned about empathy, and with all that being said, and that point is driven home in a way that is very poignant, this idea that capitalism is at play and the American dream is it's disappearing or it never existed in the first place. But there is empathy for this young, baby-faced kind of kid who had talent, who went through, and you see these shots. You have some great footage in the film where you see Elvis being interviewed, or Elvis surrounded by people, and you see him on stage. But there's this concept that I don't know. There's a great, I forgot who said it, but the idea that the before the Beatles, the girls would be lined up.
Mike Myers.
Yeah, Mike Myers in front of Paramount. And Colonel Parker would put a blanket over his head, Elvis's head, so they wouldn't know that Elvis was coming through. And then after the Beatles, the girls disappeared. And Colonel Parker continued to put the blanket over his head because he didn't want Elvis to know that the girls left. And when you hear that, and that's it pierces your that's the core of the empathy for Elvis, because you recognize that I don't know how I would deal with that kind of situation.
Yeah, I mean, he could have been you, he could have been me, he could have been anybody who just was in the right place at the right time with a special kind of authenticity and a special kind of talent. And what then happens to him, and listen, Elvis had an amazing life. It was cut short, but I think Elvis Presley was very proud to be Elvis Presley, and it's not like Cry Me a River, you're Elvis Presley.
Yeah, right.
It's more, what does it tell us about ourselves that we destroy the Elvis Presleys, that we raise these meteoric figures up, and they demonstrate something totally futile and paradoxical about the American dream? Because what happened to Elvis is what's happened to America, and it's bad for both. Elvis was a country boy who became a king. Country boys shouldn't be kings floating in the back of a Rolls Royce, divorced from their public, trying to remember their home in Tupelo, looking out the window at the poor people lined by the side of the road. Right. That's the stuff of a despot. That's the stuff of old royalty.
Right.
So that's not a good outcome for a country boy. That's not a fable you would write. But likewise, America, which was a republic that thrust onto the world stage, talking about human dignity and liberty and the rest, now we're a nuclear weapons power that tortures people, has a corrupt megalomaniac billionaire, maybe lunatic, at the helm, because the system is so vulnerable, because the economic corruption is so bad that people got so desperate they reached out for even an abusive rebound guy. That ain't a great fable either.
Yeah,
but that's where both are.
Yeah, I just think you're a tremendous filmmaker. Watching your film, a part of, and I want to shift the conversation to making this film. So the conceit is that you got his Rolls Royce, which yes. is an amazing car, 1963 car, and you see it in a lot of his promotional shots, and people know that car, and you were able to outfit it with cameras and have your guests sit in the back. Why that choice? What was it about the concept of using that car and getting prominent figures to sit in that car while you drive?
Once upon a time, I was not making a film with a car in it. I was making a poetical look at Elvis and the country he left behind. And I knew I wanted to go to key milestones in his life and kind of be there, meet key people who were there. If you were in Nashville, you'd love to talk to Emmylou Harris if you could. But you also want to talk to some gas station attendant who was once there when Elvis got in a fist fight outside the station. You know, you wanted a realness to Elvis, but you also wanted somebody who didn't know Elvis at all, who just lives in Memphis and is going to tell you about Memphis today. Well, all of a sudden, one day, as we were making that other film, you know, John Lennon says life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans. Well, you can apply that to making a good documentary. If you're open, the good film is what happens to you when you're busy making a pretty mediocre film. My other film, the one that didn't have a car in it, that would have been nice, and I'm not sure we'd be talking about it the same way now. But when this Rolls Royce became available, it was coming up for auction, and we learned about that. We had to figure out, can we convince the production, the financing behind this film, to open up the budget so that they could go buy that film, that car, so that we could then take it on a road trip across America and make a great American road movie to all those places.
There's something about it, and I think it's the genius of you as a producer and a filmmaker that translates to me when I'm watching it that this is something special. It's a moment. It's not just looking back in history or a theory that you want to play with in the film. It's a moment when John Hayek gets in the car or Emmylou Harris gets in the car, and you're able to capture the emotion they're having to what Elvis Presley meant to them and this car meant to them. It definitely puts it in another gear.
Yeah, and it doesn't, it may sound cute just to hear about it, but it's really more fundamental when you see the film. The car breaks down all the time. And this is, of course, a little bit of a metaphor. We didn't mean it that way. We would have liked it to keep running, but it's an old 1963 Grand Dame of a car. I mean, it's a real old lady. And the thing breaks down and you have to take very special care. And we figured out all kinds of coffee cans and things we shove in that engine to make it work. But while they're waiting, John Hyde is like sitting in the car watching traffic go by. And there's a humor to that and there's something poignant about it. But for the viewer, it means they're really on a road trip that could go wrong at any moment. And therefore, it's not like a traditional documentary.
It just makes it real.
It's a road movie.
Yeah, it's not polished in the way that you're like, yeah, the car would break down. There's a whole scene of people trying to figure out with the hood up. You know, I mean, there's something that makes it real that you know that this. And there's a great moment as well in the film where you get Dan Rather and you go up to the top of the Empire State Building. And it's not just about Elvis. It's about New York. It's about this country. How much in filmmaking for you is about where you put these subjects, where you interview these subjects?
It can be very poignant where you put someone, and it can be over the top and dangerous. For example, He Who Shall Remain Nameless, who occupies the Oval Office, when we were making the film, we hit Manchester, New Hampshire, and in Manchester I learned that his people had inquired whether he could go in the car as part of being in Manchester and trying to look American. And I had to think about putting such a person in Elvis Presley's car. And I concluded that he was the embodiment of everything that destroyed Elvis and that it would be toxic to put him in Elvis's car. So there's an example where I thought that isn't good to do with the car. That is not the right person or setting. And then there are other people where I want to film them in a specific place. I'm not going to go to Sun Records where Sam Phillips discovered Elvis and say to the guys at Sun Records who are Sam Phillips's children, Jerry Phillips, say to him, hey, Jerry, let's go to a studio somewhere. It's like, no, let's be in your studio. Right. Where Elvis recorded. So each place, there are times where you want something very symbolic. There are people you want in the car. For example, Chuck D. I did Chuck D in a domestic setting, not in the car, because Chuck...
He has no Elvis relation to... Yeah, right.
Elvis doesn't own Chuck D. Chuck D is his own force of nature, and he can look out over that car going by, just like he could look out over the Olympics, just like he could look out over the state of popular music, just like he could look out over quantum physics. And I wanted him, who has that kind of a seismic intellect, to have that kind of omniscient view, where the car is one thing, Elvis is another thing, race is another thing, so forth.
But and I love it, too, because John Hyatt may be inspired by Elvis and really be in the car, but Elvis... may inspire Chuck D in different ways, meaning it's not getting in the car, it's not going to have an emotional attachment to Chuck D
in a different way. And, you know, John Hyatt gets in the car, and this was incredible for me because it was one of the first few days I was filming, and I was always thinking, I wonder if this is a good idea. You're always insecure. You're wondering whether you're on a stupid idea or not. And this was such a big idea that if it was a stupid idea, it was a big stupid right, idea. Right. So I'm like pretty insecure, and I'm wondering, calling my mom and my friends, am I doing a crazy thing here? And John Hyatt got in the car, and I was kind of rummaging around getting some stuff ready, and I look in the back seat, and he's bawling. And this isn't that common that like an interviewee shows up to your movie and bursts into tears.
And they know cameras are around. Yeah, they
and
know.
Is a grown man.
Right.
And I said, are you okay? And he said, yeah, it's just overwhelming in here, like to think how trapped Elvis was. And for John Hyatt, who's a country rocker who idolized Elvis, who has, you know, he made Riding with the King, he's hugely invested in Elvis, to see how it overtook him was a real affirmation to me. You're really on something here. Yeah. Just keep going with it. Just keep going.
Well, the film is at the Music Box Theater. The King, the award-winning filmmaker, Eugene Jarecki, my guest, and download. I can't recommend it more highly. It's just an amazing film. I learned so much about Elvis Presley, but I also learned about this country. So thanks for making it, and thanks for being my guest.
Thank you. 1989, the number, another summer. Sound of the funky drummer, music hitting your heart, cause I know you got soul. Hey. Listen if you're missing y'all, swinging while I'm singing. Hey. Giving what you're getting, knowing what I'm knowing, while the black band's sweating in the rhythm I'm rolling. Gotta give us what we want, gotta give us what we need. Hey. Our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power! Fight the power! Fight the power! Fight the power! We gotta fight the power that beats. As the rhythm's designed to bounce with counts that the rhyme designed to fill your mind. Now that you realize the prize arrives, we got to pump the stuff to make it tough. From the heart, it's a start, a work of art to revolutionize, make a change, something strange. People, people, we are the same. No, we're not the same, cause we don't know the game. What we need is awareness. We can't get careless. You say, what is this? Yeah. I'm beloved. Let's get down to business. Mental self-defense or fitness. The rest is show. You got to go with what you know. To make everybody see. In order to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. 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 We've got to fight the power that be.
Check.